KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
During his campaign, Donald Trump distanced himself from the conservative policy blueprint Project 2025.
In his first 100 days, he has incorporated many of its policies and authors into his administration.
For Wednesday, April 30th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. This hour, a look at the future of a special office connecting two federal agencies that both work on electric vehicles.
It's become a casualty of the push to shrink the government.
I'm not sure we'll have any full-time people left in the joint office.
Also, the latest on the Columbia University student arrested and detained by immigration agents in Vermont.
We will not fear anyone because our fight is a fight for love, is a fight for democracy, is a fight for humanity.
Those stories and more all coming up after this summary of today's news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments today on a conflict between church and state. There are indications conservatives on the court are open to approving religious charter schools. NPR's Nina Totenberg says the test case from Oklahoma could transform public education.
On one side of the case are two Catholic dioceses in Oklahoma. Representing them is lawyer James Campbell.
You can't create a public program and then just simply say that no religious organization can apply.
On the other side is the state's Republican Attorney General, Gentner Drummond.
Religious liberty is really the freedom to worship. It is not taxpayer-funded, state-sponsored religious indoctrination.
A decision in the case is expected by summer. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
New census data shows Latinos and Asian Americans continue to have some of the lowest voter registration rates among eligible voters. As NPR's Hansi Luong explains, researchers blamed long-standing barriers to registering to vote that made it difficult to close the racial and ethnic gaps.
Results from the Census Bureau's current population survey about last year's general election show the rates of Asian and Latino citizens age 18 or older signed up to cast ballots trail behind the rate for white adult citizens. The registration gap between white and Latino eligible voters is around 14 percentage points. And between white and Asian eligible voters, the gap is about 9 percentage points. Researchers point out many Latino and Asian American eligible voters are naturalized U.S. citizens. That can make it more difficult to find out how to get registered to vote, especially in states that don't offer automatic voter registration or same-day registration. Also, restrictive voter ID requirements disproportionately affect many eligible voters of color, who are more likely than white citizens to say they lack documents proving their citizenship. Hansi Luong, NPR News, Washington.
France is accusing Russia of carrying out more than a decade of cyber attacks. As NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports, targets include national government ministries, companies, the presidential election, and even the Paris Olympics.
A report just out from France's National Cybersecurity Agency outlines cyber attacks from 2021 through 2024. It attributes them to a group called AP28, also known as Fancy Bear, which is linked to Russia's military intelligence agency. The report says the hackers aimed to collect intelligence, notably in the context of Russia's war in Ukraine. France is one of Ukraine's most vocal backers, and President Emmanuel Macron is working to ensure that an eventual U.S.-brokered peace deal doesn't further embolden Russia and threaten Europe's security. The Russian ambassador to France denied the accusations. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
The U.S. economy was shrinking during the first 3 months of the year. President Trump blaming the 0.3% decline in the gross domestic product on former President Joe Biden, who left office months ago, where many economists blame Trump's own stewardship of the economy, including his on-again, off-again tariffs. On Wall Street, the Dow was up 141 points. This is NPR. China has decided to drop sanctions against five members of the European Parliament. NPR's Emily Fang reports China's reversal on those sanctions comes as Beijing is trying to further woo Europeans as relations with the U.S. deteriorate.
In 2021, China sanctioned more than a dozen Europeans and organizations critical of Beijing's policies in the Xinjiang region, where the United Nations says China may have committed crimes against humanity. But fast forward more than 4 years, and China has been telegraphing that it wants to resume talks on a stymied investment pact with the European Union. Negotiations the EU froze because of these Chinese sanctions. So now China's removed sanctions on the European politicians, but not some of the other individuals and organizations. An advocacy group with ties to those EU politicians says, quote, "The removal of some sanctions does not constitute a favor that warrants concessions from the European Union." Emily Fang, NPR News.
The Trump administration is enlisting more federal agencies to help with its immigration enforcement agenda. According to the Washington Post, that includes the law enforcement arm of the U.S. Postal Service. USPS has not replied to NPR's request for comment. When asked about working with the U.S. Postal Inspection Service, a senior official with the Department of Homeland Security only said DHS, quote, "We use every tool and resource available to secure our border and get criminals without legal status out of the country." Crude oil futures prices continued their downward slide today, posting their biggest monthly drop in almost 3.5 years. Oil fell $2.21 a barrel to $58.21 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. A few blocks from the U.S. Capitol, there is now a banner about 7 stories tall draped on the side of an office building. It reads, "America's Back, the First 100 Days," and below it, the face of President Trump and a short list of ongoing agenda items. The building is the headquarters of the Heritage Foundation, the conservative think tank, which last year unveiled Project 2025. It's a detailed plan for a future Republican administration to roll out in the event of an election victory. Though candidate Trump distanced himself from this plan, so far President Trump is claiming power to remake the federal government, increase immigration enforcement, assert a new trade policy based on tariffs, and pursuing many other policies in ways that were laid out in Project 2025. Heritage Foundation President Kevin Roberts joins us now. Thank you for making the time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I just want to start by asking you, many of the Trump administration's actions so far are quite similar to what we saw laid out in Project 2025. Has that been validating for your organization?
We're honestly not worried about being validated. We've been around 53 years, and by that, I don't imply any hubris, certainly don't intend it, Juana. What I mean instead is that the American people are the ones who should be taking a victory lap, because what President Trump and Vice President Vance and what I think is the best cabinet in modern American political history have done is begin the dismantling of the administrative state that gives self-governance and power back to the American people. If the Heritage Foundation and the large coalition, 110 organizations we assembled last year, have a tiny role in providing some ideas and some of the people to help that happen, it's something we do every 4 years, then we're very happy about that. But not for us, instead for the American people.
All right, let's start there with what you mentioned, dismantling the administrative state. That language is one of the top agenda items that appears on the banner that hangs on that building. Is it fair to say that part of this project requires dramatically reducing the federal workforce through layoffs, reductions in force or RIFs, reclassification of jobs?
It's fair to say that over the next 5 or 10 years, and certainly starting in the first few months of the administration, that there need to be, through a variety of channels, in several in addition to those that you mentioned, a reduction in federal workforce. We're hopeful for our fellow Americans who are employees of the federal government that they're able to find employment elsewhere. And there's nothing against them as people. The problem is that the federal government has become far too bloated. And a good way to think about this is, for every one of these federal jobs, just on average, there are exceptions to this to be sure, for every one of those federal jobs, there is a small example, a small accrual, if you will, of expense and federal power that comes to the expense of other Americans who have lost their jobs because of that centralized power. That's really the way we ought to be thinking about this. And that's why this effort in dismantling the administration state is so important for the everyday hardworking American.
To your mind, what would be the right amount of additional cuts? Where would you like to see them and how many?
Well, we're huge supporters of the total elimination of the U.S. Department of Education, not because we want to issue any harm to education, quite the opposite. We believe, looking at our data since the creation of the department since 1979, that after spending $1.6 trillion on that department, and of course having a nationwide bipartisan effort to have excellent education, all we've seen, unfortunately, we lament this, is mediocrity. So the elimination of that department is a good start. Obviously, some of the very appropriate civil rights roles that one of the sub-agencies of that department performs ought to be moved to the Department of Justice. In addition to that, though, just a couple of quick examples, if I may, the law enforcement mechanism of the Environmental Protection Agency, the redundant agencies we see or sub-agencies across the departments are great places to start. Interestingly, it's been the usage of AI technology that has revealed a lot of these redundancies. And in the same way that maybe at NPR or at Heritage or in some private corporations, we'd have to go through the same exercise, the federal government is long overdue for such an effort.
I want to jump in here for a second. You've talked about redundancies. You've alluded to government waste. Project 2025 did not necessarily spell out the creation of the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, but it is carrying out several recommendations of the plan. How do you evaluate the success of DOGE? Are you happy with the work that it's doing?
You know, DOGE is a wonderful creation of President Trump and Elon Musk. It is an excellent example of how President Trump's instincts match something the conservative movement has long wanted, as you know, which is a reduction in the expense of the federal government, but obviously doing so in a way that's very accelerated. We think that DOGE is ahead of schedule. We believe, or at least we're very hopeful, that DOGE will continue to add to the savings that they've discovered thus far as we have this conversation that's $160 billion. We're hopeful they'll get to their goal of $1 trillion by the end of the calendar.
Jump in there. I believe that DOGE actually once promised $2 trillion in savings, now revise that to $150 billion, and even that number may be tough to achieve given the inaccurate claims that NPR and other outlets have tracked. Given that many federal agencies already had oversight in the form of Congress, internal inspector generals, is it possible that it's overstating the amount of waste that exists to be found and eliminated?
No, I think it's still early in the process. In fact, it's remarkable that, as we've seen the federal government get so large and bloated since the New Deal, that in a span of only 3.5 months, DOGE has identified $160 billion in savings. Time will tell about how much they in fact save. Our estimates at Heritage are that they'll be much closer to $1 trillion. But keep in mind, more importantly than even the quibble we're having about what they have identified now in terms of dollar savings, what they have changed in Washington, D.C., no longer is the question, can we in fact save money? The answer is we already are. Look at the GDP report that came out. The reason that GDP is down a little bit is because the first time since Trump was in office in his first term, government is spending less money. We need years and decades of that to get this country back on track.
I want to get to another item that's a key agenda item of President Trump, and that is securing the border. Project 2025 called for mass deportations. From your view, is the Trump administration doing this in the most effective way possible?
They are. I mean, the biggest obstacle to this are the several dozen sanctuary cities who are housing illegal aliens who are felons, who ought to be not only out of this country, but in prisons like the one in El Salvador. And the problem with this is for illegal aliens who are not felons, which is a majority of them, some of them actually are subject to being rounded up in these ICE raids because mayors of these sanctuary cities are housing these felons. It would be good if those obstacles get out of the way so we can focus on the real lawbreakers.
You've brought up sanctuary cities. I want to bring up some of the court challenges the administration is facing in some of these high-profile cases. Courts have said that everyone deported under the Alien Enemies Act are constitutionally owed due process, a meaningful opportunity to challenge their deportations. Legally, is this administration carrying out the immigration objectives laid out in the plan in ways you approve of?
100%. Illegal aliens are owed one process, and that's an immigration court hearing. They've received that. a great example of the absurdity of some of these legal claims, as well as the rhetoric by some policymakers and those in corporate media, is the so-called Maryland man, who's not at all a Maryland man whatsoever, but an El Salvador man.
You're speaking there about the case of Kilmar Abrego Garcia, correct?
That's correct.
In that case, he was deported despite a court order which was supposed to present this. The government has refused to return him to the United States for a deportation hearing, despite a Supreme Court order which asked the government to facilitate this. Is the administration
facilitates the operative word. And in fact, that El Salvador man has been found twice in an immigration court to be a member and leader of MS-13. He is in El Salvador, where he should stay for
his lawyers have contended that he is not. And he has said
his lawyers are well paid by the radical left, and they're lying.
Is the administration in that case making a fair claim of executive power?
Not only fair, we celebrate it, and it's one of the reasons we put the banner on the side of our building. It's glorious.
Do you worry that deportations under this administration could be taken too far? For instance, the claims that we have reported on and others, President Trump has suggested that he is considering deporting American citizens who are convicted of crimes to El Salvador.
I don't think they go too far. In fact, Tom Homan, the border czar, is a great friend of ours. He was a visiting fellow here at Heritage. I know him to be not only extraordinarily competent, but also extraordinarily virtuous. He makes the decisions he does for the sake of the everyday American, not for the sake of illegal aliens who should never have come here to begin with.
I will just jump in again.
It's focused on that and not on the 21 million people who
arrived. Sir, I'm going to jump in again here. I'm asking about President Trump's comments suggesting that he is considering deporting American citizens who are convicted of crimes to El Salvador.
And I told you I'm not worried about it. And I'm asking you why you wouldn't, with all the audience you have, be more focused on the negative effects of 21 million people being here illegally, 168,000 of whom we know are convicted felons.
I'm going to move on to another topic here. Project 2025 is supportive of reciprocal tariffs. Are you pleased with what you've seen so far?
So far, so good. I will say that we're hopeful that as Treasury Secretary Bessent and Commerce Secretary Lutnick continue to take a leadership role in the negotiating of bilateral trade agreements, that we'll see more clarity about a zealous focus of a reciprocal tariff regime generally, to the point of your question. But as we have called for at Heritage over the last 3 years, because we believe we're in a new Cold War with China, a very zealous focus on the Chinese Communist Party. If this tariff regime continues to move toward that, then I think that there will be great benefits, economic, political, national security, social, and otherwise.
We've got about a minute left here. I just want to note that we've seen such volatility in the stock market for weeks. Investors have lost billions, and there is economic data out today showing the economy contracting. Will the president continue to have the support he needs if the economy perhaps tips into recession?
It looks like it, and I think it's too early to say that the economy will go into a recession. In fact, I think it's at least as likely, given the data we saw today, which is much more positive than has been suggested, that the economy will be fine. No doubt, to your point, the market has been choppy. The market was going to be choppy anyway. There are a lot of large corporations that have been significantly overvalued in the market. It's a factor that ought to be considered here. But the point is that as the administration continues to clarify its tariff regime, but most importantly, as it continues to share news about potential, maybe even likely bilateral trade agreements, I think you're going to see the economy actually take off and be very positive the rest of the year.
We'll have to leave it there. That's Kevin Roberts, president of the Heritage Foundation and its lobbying arm, Heritage Action for America. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you. Support for NPR comes from this station and from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. A Columbia University student detained by authorities at his naturalization interview is free. For now, a federal judge in Vermont ordered Mohsen Mahdawi released on bond today. He had been in prison for 2 weeks after his arrest earlier this month. Mahdawi is a lawful permanent resident of the U.S., lives in Vermont, and as I mentioned, as a student at Columbia, where his pro-Palestinian activism caught the attention of the Trump administration. Vermont Public's Sabine Pooks was at Madawi's hearing today in Burlington. Hi, Sabine.
Hey.
So alert listeners will have recognized Mahdawi's name because he just gave NPR his first interview. Our colleague Leila Fadel sat down with him a few days ago inside a Vermont correctional facility. So this today is quite a twist. What did the judge say in his order?
Yes. So Judge Jeffrey Crawford said Mahdawi does not pose a threat to his community here in Vermont, nor is he a flight risk. 2 points that the federal government was trying to argue in court today. And he also said that Madawi's continued detention would likely have a, quote, chilling effect on protected speech. Now, that's something Madawi's lawyers have also argued. They maintain Mahdawi was arrested because he spoke out for the rights of Palestinian people while he was at Columbia. As a student, he co-founded the Palestinian Student Union and was a vocal advocate for peace in Gaza. Secretary of State Marco Rubio referenced that activism in his justification for detaining Mahdawi. He said he should be deported because his advocacy threatened U.S. foreign policy goals. And in court today, the government also argued Mahdawi posed a threat to his community, referencing a decade-old police report that his lawyers say was investigated and closed years ago.
I mentioned you were there at the courthouse today when he was set free. Describe the scene for me.
Yes, so friends and supporters spent the morning gathered around the courthouse. Many of them cried and hugged each other when Mahdawi left the building after the hearing. He flashed peace signs and addressed the crowd while people cheered.
And we send a clear message as well that if we have faith in our beliefs, unshakable beliefs, which is the belief that justice is inevitable, we will not fear anyone because our fight is a fight for love, is a fight for democracy, is a fight for humanity.
Amen. Now, in response to the judge's order, the Trump administration said it's committed to restoring the rule of law in the U.S. immigration system. And it said, quote, no judge, not this one or any other, is going to stop us from doing that.
Are there conditions on his release?
Yes. Judge Crawford said Mahdawi must continue to reside in Vermont, that he can travel to New York State for school or to meet with his lawyers, and that he must attend all court hearings in this case in person.
And what does he say he's going to do next?
So even though he's been released from prison, the immigration case against him is only just beginning. Madawi's lawyers say there's a remote hearing in that case tomorrow. For now, though, he's free to go home, and that's a big relief to his community here in the Upper Valley region of Vermont. Mahdawi has a lot of friends who've been checking in on him while he's been in prison. I spoke with one of them, Don Foster, the week Mahdawi was detained. He says he's like one of his sons.
He's become an integral part of the Upper Valley, and the Upper Valley would be at a loss without Mohsen and people like Mohsen.
Reporting there from Vermont Public, Sabine Pooks, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Today, the Supreme Court's conservative majority seemed to be on the verge of taking a transformative step, a step that would, for the first time, allow overtly religious schools to be fully funded by the taxpayers. NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports.
Oklahoma, like 45 other states, has charter schools that allow for more flexibility and innovation in education. But under both the federal charter school law and similar state laws, charter schools are public schools that are funded by the state, closely supervised by the state, and most importantly for today's case, by law, the schools must be non-sectarian. Challenging that non-religious requirement today were two Catholic dioceses in Oklahoma that tried to establish a publicly funded Catholic school as a charter school. The Oklahoma Supreme Court ruled that would directly contradict the state and federal constitutional bans on state-sponsored religious indoctrination. Today at the Supreme Court, the questions posed by the conservative justices seem to lean heavily in favor of allowing publicly funded religious schools in the charter schools program. Justice Brett Kavanaugh strongly telegraphed his views with questions like this.
All the religious school is saying is don't exclude us on account of our religion. And when you have a program that's open to all comers except religion, that seems like rank discrimination against religion.
Justices Alito, Gorsuch, and Thomas asked similar questions, also contending that to leave a religious school out of the charter school program amounts to discrimination against religious adherents and their constitutional right to the free exercise of religion. Chief Justice Roberts was a bit harder to read, but only the court's three liberals were openly skeptical of the notion that a Catholic school dedicated to teaching the Word of Christ could be part of a public charter school program entirely funded by the government. Justice Kagan, addressing one of the lawyers representing the archdioceses, noted that the charter school system was enacted to increase curricular flexibility. Schools that, for example, focus more on the arts or on math and science or language proficiency.
It did not want to start funding every religious school in the country. And now you're saying to that state, yes, you have to go fund the yeshiva. Yes, you have to go fund the madras. Yes, you have to go fund da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
If that's the case, she added, there will be a line out the door for religious schools to be incorporated into the public charter school program. Representing the Trump administration and religious groups, Solicitor General John Sauer maintained that allowing religious charter schools to coexist with non-religious schools does not violate the Constitution.
The decision whether or not to go to the religious school lies in the hands of the parents.
Lawyer Gregory Garr, representing Oklahoma, replied that the state provides vouchers and tax benefits to parents who want to send their children to private religious schools, but he maintained that since public schools were first adopted in the mid-1800s, the state and federal constitutions have not allowed private religious schools to be directly funded by the government. Changing that long-held constitutional norm, he said, could have profound and hugely divergent consequences across the nation.
Our traditions are not to allow the teaching of religion in our public schools.
He said that if the court rules for the Catholic Church in this case, the effect would be to sow uncertainty, confusion, and disruption for millions of schoolchildren and families across the country. Charter schools are, without exception, public schools, he said, noting that in New Orleans, for example, the city's only public schools are charter schools. What, he asked, would teachers be able to teach if religious schools were added to public charter schools? How would the nation's disability rights laws apply for children? What would the curriculum be if a religious school barred the teaching of evolution? Can you have a gay teacher or not? The questions, he said, are infinite and could tie up school districts in litigation for years. Justice Amy Coney Barrett recused herself from participating in today's case. That means the court could conceivably be deadlocked, though the odds of that looked remote today. A decision in the case is expected by early summer. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News.
The Trump administration has been slashing budgets for public health, environmental protection, and education. Big donors and billionaires have stepped up to fill that gap, but most have a different approach.
You've seen lots of foundations either say explicitly or sort of implicitly message that they don't have enough money to do this sort of thing.
Can philanthropy replace public funding? That's tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Coming up, President Trump is putting pressure on the power dynamics among the White House, Congress, and the courts.
Regardless of who the president is and regardless of which party controls Congress, I see the decline of a Congress that legislates as a serious constitutional crisis.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. A federal appeals court has voted to keep a block on DOGE staffers' access to sensitive Social Security data while that appeal plays out. NPR's Stephen Fowler has more on the filing.
Mid-April, a federal judge granted a preliminary injunction that essentially blocked Department of Government Efficiency staffers at the Social Security Administration from accessing sensitive data. The government appealed and asked for that ban to be lifted while the appeal is considered. But now, a majority of the Fourth Circuit's judges has agreed to have the whole bench consider the motion to stay, and in a 9-6 vote, the judges voted to keep the preliminary injunction in place. Stephen Fowler, NPR News, Atlanta.
China released new data showing its economy is starting to feel the pinch from U.S. tariffs. NPR's John Ruwitch has more.
China's new export orders slumped sharply in April. That's according to the Government Statistics Bureau. A gauge of new orders was at its lowest since China was largely sealed off from the rest of the world in 2022 during the coronavirus pandemic. A broader measure of factory activity called the Purchasing Managers Index registered 49 in April, its weakest level in more than a year. Readings under 50 indicate activity is contracting. In early April, President Trump's Liberation Day tariffs triggered tit-for-tat escalation with China on products going both directions. China's goods coming into the United States are now mostly subject to tariffs of 145% or more. Manufacturers and exporters in China have said orders from the U.S. and shipments to America had mostly ground to a halt. John Ruwitch, NPR News, Shanghai.
Here in California, the Port of Los Angeles says shipping cargo will drop 35% next week as new China tariffs take a bite. Some of the 1 million jobs tied to the port could be affected as a result of the new 145% tariffs on Chinese goods by the Trump administration. Shipments from China make up 45% of business at the West Coast port. This is NPR. A remote Colorado tourist attraction dedicated to UFOs is making a big anniversary and renewed interest, as we hear from Dan Boyce of Colorado Public Radio.
Judy Messaline started her UFO watchtower as a joke 25 years ago after her ranching operation fell on hard times.
But in the same token, we have had 304 sightings from just here.
It's not much, basically just a steel viewing platform 10 feet off the ground and a gift shop. Still, she says people have been taking her joke a lot more seriously. This in the wake of declassified fighter pilot footage appearing to show UFOs. She expects about 10,000 people to visit the watchtower this summer, starting with a 25th anniversary party on Memorial Day. Could be a fine time for first contact. For NPR News, I'm Dan Boyce in Colorado's San Luis Valley.
Visa wants to use an artificial intelligence agent to help consumers in the near future with some of their most mundane tasks. Think buying groceries, even purchasing airline tickets. San Francisco-based payment processing company has been working for several months now with leading AI chatbot developers. Visa says it's still working on some technical fixes before consumers can ask an AI assistant to order their groceries. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Nature Conservancy, committed to protecting and preserving the planet during Earth Month and every month through the bold power of local and global action. nature.org/NPR. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. Over the last 100 days, President Trump and his allies have exercised control over everything from immigration and trade to education, science institutions, and the federal workforce. Many of Trump's actions are a direct challenge to the courts and to Congress, the two branches of government designed to act as checks on presidential power. NPR political correspondents Mara Liasson and Susan Davis have been covering this power dynamic. They join me now. Hi to both of you.
Hi there.
Mara, if you could kick us off, I want to start here with just a very basic question. What is at stake with this push from President Trump and his allies to consolidate power within the executive branch?
What's at stake is our system of government. You know, the founders designed a system with three co-equal branches. They believed in broadly distributed power, what we call checks and balances. They knew that they couldn't stop someone from being elected who they would have said had monarchical tendencies. They wouldn't have said authoritarian. But they did think that this broadly distributed power system could stop that person from doing a lot of damage if he was elected. But now we're going to have a test of that, because the judiciary, which is one of the co-equal branches, cannot enforce its ruling. It depends on willing acceptance of its role as a co-equal branch of government by the executive. And we are now in the midst of a kind of rolling escalation of confrontation between the executive and the judicial branch. And depending on how it comes out, we might end up with a system that has a vastly empowered executive and a kind of withered judicial and legislative branch.
Sue, over to you. When Congress is controlled by the same party as the White House as it is now, there's not generally much pushback on the president. So tell us what's different about this moment.
Right. Like, part of this isn't a new story. Congress, over many decades, has been ceding power to the executive. Some scholars would argue that dates back as far as the New Deal. But no president has gone as far as Donald Trump to intrude on Congress's constitutional power to decide how taxpayer dollars are spent. This Elon Musk-led effort to cut spending has effectively shuttered agencies and institutions funded by Congress. And Republican lawmakers have, by and large, just gotten out of their way. This is Speaker Mike Johnson back in February saying he supported what the president was doing.
It looks radical. It's not. I call it stewardship. I think they're doing right by the American taxpayer, and we support that principle.
The speaker did acknowledge that a lot of these actions are going to be challenged in the courts, and they'll have to respect that.
I'll just note, though, it's not just DOGE. The president is also trying to effectively legislate from the Oval Office through executive orders on practically everything from immigration to election law.
Right. Like, consider that in his first 100 days, Trump has issued around 139 executive actions. That's almost as much, Juana, as former President Biden issued in his entire 4 years in office. In that same 100-day time period, Congress has only passed 5 laws. It's the lowest number in decades. But again, Trump is not the first president to make law. Recall, former President Biden tried to do the same thing with his student loan forgiveness program. That was struck down by the Supreme Court. But Trump is certainly acting as an accelerant on this practice.
Well, Mara, if Republicans control the White House and Congress, why doesn't Trump just try to propose and pass legislation, which is the way, as a former congressional reporter, the system was intended to work?
It was intended to work that way. But if you have an extremely small majority, as the Republicans do, that means you have to compromise. And that's hard. And when past presidents tried to do very big lifts and big, ambitious pieces of legislation, they had bigger majorities. But also, not passing a lot of things through legislation goes with the President Trump's concept of executive power. He is the EO president, not the legislative president. And he gravitates towards things like immigration and foreign policy and trade, which were areas where presidents have a pretty free hand. They don't need the judicial branch or the executive branch to do what they want to do. But the other thing about executive orders is they are not permanent. What executive orders giveth, the executive orders of the next president can take it away.
And I also think Trump has benefited from a reality in which Congress has been incapable for years of passing legislation to solve tough issues. I think immigration is probably the best example of that. Former President Reagan was the last president to sign a comprehensive immigration bill into law. So when Congress is this dysfunctional, it just creates an opportunity for the president to act on those issues.
I got to ask about the politics here. Republicans control the House by just a narrow 2-seat margin, which I imagine must factor into the calculations on Capitol Hill.
Always. I mean, the party in the White House almost always loses seats in the midterms. And I talked to Kevin Kosar about this. He's a congressional scholar with the right-leaning American Enterprise Institute. And he spoke to what I think is a pretty commonly held view here in D.C., that Republicans are likely operating within a 2-year window.
The amount of deference that legislators are showing is to some degree like, we just have to do this to see if we can rack up as many wins as possible, because those midterms are probably not going to go our way.
The majority largely rises or falls on the popularity of the president. So there's really no ability for Republicans here to create any daylight with Trump. So they just have to go all in.
Mara, I'll let you have the last word. Was any of this a surprise to the voters who came out and voted for Trump based on promises to make, well, exactly the kind of changes that we're seeing him make right now?
Well, I'm sure to some people it has been a surprise. They thought his first priority would be to bring down prices. But remember, people were tired of a broken, gridlocked Congress. That's why Trump got elected. He was the change candidate, and voters wanted change. But what Sue's talking about, Congress abdicating its responsibilities, is so important here. I mean, Congress is the Article I branch of government. The founders put it first. They thought the Congress was the best branch to serve the idea of self-governance because Congress is closest to the public. They serve 2-year terms.
That is NPR's Mara Liasson and Susan Davis. Thanks to both of you.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
Israel's ban of the UN agency assisting Palestinians and its blockade of all aid into Gaza have been heavily criticized this week in the International Court of Justice. The U.S. voiced support for its ally today, saying it's up to Israel to decide who it will work with to deliver aid to Palestinians, especially to the more than 2 million living in Gaza. NPR's Carrie Kahn reports.
More than 40 countries and organizations are testifying before the United Nations High Court. Nearly all object to an Israeli law passed last year banning the UN aid agency for Palestinian refugees known as UNRWA. Israel says UNRWA is infiltrated by Hamas militants and that some of its employees were involved in the October 7, 2023 attack on Israel. UNRWA dismissed 9 employees but says Israel's evidence didn't prove a significant Hamas infiltration. U.S. State Department lawyer Joshua Simmons told the court Israel doesn't consider UNRWA impartial and has every right to not work with it.
To be clear, the United States supports the flow of humanitarian aid into Gaza with safeguards to ensure it is not looted or misused by terrorist groups.
The UN asked the High Court for a non-binding opinion about Israel's obligations to provide aid to Palestinians. Israel has blocked all aid from coming into Gaza for the past 2 months. Monday, Palestinian ambassador to the Netherlands, Amar Hijazi, accused Israel of violating international law.
It is about Israel turning Palestine, and particularly Gaza, into a mass grave for Palestinians and those coming to their aid.
The humanitarian conditions in Gaza are dire. The UN's World Food Program says it has no more food to distribute to charity kitchens that provide meals for half of Gaza's residents. Bakeries have shut and prices in markets have skyrocketed. Israel did not participate in the hearings. Its foreign minister accused the court of weaponizing international law to, quote, deprive the most attacked country in the world, Israel, of its most basic right to defend itself. Carrie Kahn, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Sundar Pichai, the CEO of Google, testified today in the final phase of a historic antitrust trial. Last year, a judge ruled the tech giant has a monopoly in the online search market. Today, Pichai defended Google against the Justice Department's proposed penalties, which he called, quote, extraordinary. And just as a note, Google is a financial supporter of NPR. NPR's Jacqueline Diaz was in court today. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Jacqueline, start by telling us a bit about why Pichai was in court this morning.
Sure. So last summer, U.S. District Judge Ahmed Maeda ruled that Google has been acting as a search engine monopoly. Now he'll decide which penalties Google will face. The Justice Department has asked him to rule that Google must license its search data, spin off its Chrome browser, and stop doing exclusive deals that make Google the default search engine on phones. And Pichai was their subject to all of that. Dressed in a dark suit, he confidently took the stand at the federal court in Washington, D.C. We're about midway through this three-week set of hearings, and compared to other witnesses, Pichai's testimony was short and sweet, about an hour and a half. Pichai had some strong words about the DOJ's proposed penalties. He said they are so far-reaching and extraordinary, they threaten Google's core intellectual property and ability to innovate. But a lot of his testimony wasn't about search engines, it was about artificial intelligence.
Okay, tell me more about that. I thought that this whole trial was supposed to be about a monopoly on search engines.
Yeah, of course. AI and search are actually closely connected. Google has developed a massive search index, basically a giant database of all the pages and information on the web. And developers can use this kind of database to develop AI models that power things like chatbots. And Google has its own chatbot called Gemini. And the DOJ is arguing that Google has created a system where its control over search gives it an advantage to its AI products like Gemini. Then those AI products direct more users back into Google search. The government says this creates a kind of self-serving cycle that gives the company dominance in search and could potentially give it a monopoly in AI. That's why the DOJ wants Google to have to license its search data to other companies. That includes things like users' search terms and results.
And what did Google's CEO have to say about all this?
Pichai said forcing Google to share data would be a, quote, de facto divestiture of the company's search engine, and that threatens Google's decades of investment in innovation. But since these proceedings began, Google's lawyers have argued that there is a healthy competition within the AI marketplace, which includes other players like Meta and Perplexity. Pichai noted that OpenAI's ChatGPT is the market leader for AI chatbots, not Gemini. Still, Pichai said AI is really important to Google. He said they have spent roughly $49 billion on AI search and development and called it one of the most profound technologies humans will ever work on.
So, Jacqueline, tell us what comes next.
Yeah, Google's attorneys are expected to call witnesses for a few more days. That includes folks from Mozilla and Apple. And Meta is expected to issue a decision by August. Ultimately, though, Google says it plans to appeal.
NPR's Jacqueline Diaz, thank you.
Thank you.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. A few years ago, Congress had an idea, a special office connecting two federal agencies that both work on electric vehicles. But this startup within the government has become a casualty, possibly an accidental casualty, of the push to shrink the government. NPR's Camila Domonoske reports on how that office has become a ghost ship.
When Congress passed the Bipartisan Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act in 2021, it designated billions for electric vehicle chargers, especially along highways. The Department of Transportation handles all things highway. The Department of Energy knows about all things electricity. And those two?
They never really talked to each other. They certainly didn't plan together.
That's Phil Jones, who has spent years advocating for EV policies. Congress wanted them to plan together, so this law invented something new, a joint office of energy and transportation.
This was the first joint office that had ever been created at the federal level to span multiple agencies.
That's Gabe Klein, the founding director. Klein left in February, and that wasn't a surprise. New administration, new leadership. But he thought the team would continue. After all, the work was mandated by Congress. There were once close to 50 people at the joint office, but the cuts this year to probationary staff hit hard. As a newer office, there were lots of recent hires. The government also invited people to resign, but keep their pay through September. At first, a lot of people stuck around, but projects were in limbo. Across the government, people who work on climate-related topics had their work frozen, affecting contractors and staffers.
You are pretty much staring at a computer and not doing work. And for people that are motivated, that's very demotivating.
There were return-to-office mandates, new fears of future layoffs, and then in April, a second invitation to resign. It hit different. After that, Klein says,
I'm not sure we'll have any full-time people left in the joint office.
I talked with several people who recently left the joint office, who spoke on condition of anonymity because they're worried about retaliation related to their severance or former projects. They said that to their knowledge, every full-time federal employee in the office is leaving. In most cases, their last day was last Friday. The joint office still has a website, but it no longer lists any leaders or staff. And here's the twist. Despite all the actions this administration has aimed at EVs, people I spoke to don't think this was planned. There was no executive order aimed at them, and it wasn't like the new administration laid the whole team off. Here's Klein.
The joint office was not necessarily a target.
Asked about the changes, the Department of Energy said in a statement it was, quote, conducting a department-wide review to ensure activities are legal and, quote, align with the Trump administration's priorities. The Department of Transportation did not return requests for comment. The people I've talked to say that some fellows and contractors will keep working on joint office projects, but at one agency or the other, rather than living in this special space between the two. The joint office got people to talk to each other. Two different federal agencies, yes, but also the feds and the states, academics and industry, auto companies and charging companies. They worked out some technical details to make charging more reliable. So when you plug in any EV at any charger,
all right.
Especially if the car and charger are from two different companies, there's a higher chance 15 seconds later you'll be saying this.
Charging started.
Instead of saying something we can't air on NPR. Nick Nigro runs Atlas Public Policy, a policy and data research firm. He says the joint office's role bridging divides was really valuable. Without the joint office, he says, that work will still happen in the private sector.
It's just it might go slower and it might be more cost ineffective, which is sort of ironic given the current goals of the administration.
As EV infrastructure grows, energy and transportation experts have to work together somewhere. It just might not be in the home Congress made for them. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
Every week, a guest draws a card from NPR's wildcard deck and answers a big question about their life. For former U.S. poet laureate Joy Harjo, art was a literal escape as a kid. She grew up in Oklahoma as a member of the Muscogee Creek Nation. She lived with an abusive stepfather until she was able to move away and enroll in an art school. She told my colleague Rachel Martin that she writes a lot about those kinds of periods of transformation. It's a theme in her children's book, For a Girl Becoming, which is out in a new edition this week.
It's a book for coming of age, and I seem to land on that period a lot. And I think it's because I went through so much during that coming of age period. Maybe I'm just working out trauma, but I want to be helpful. I think even in trauma, that's where you learn yourself.
Yeah.
Really, that's where you learn yourself and who you are and what you're made of.
On this week's Wildcard with Rachel Martin, Joy Harjo talked more about that period of life.
Where would you go when you needed to escape as a teenager?
As a kid, I would escape into the closet as a little kid. And my drawings, they're probably still in that closet or outside. You know, I would go out at times when everyone was asleep or the world was quiet. And I still like that. That's where I find things. That's where I find images and sounds and fresh ideas. That's how I discover, I guess you could say, a kind of peacefulness, but also a kind of depth that isn't always present when you're in the realm of chatter.
Yeah. Is there something in particular that you felt that you needed to get away from when you were an adolescent? Or was it just adolescence?
Yeah, I needed to get away from adolescence. I know I always feel for those kids when I've gone in and talked to them and vibe with them because, you know, I still understand that period, which is a time of, I think of adolescence as being like a chrysalis moment, like you've got the caterpillar and eating leaves and experiencing the world as a caterpillar. And then they build this chrysalis, and the chrysalis is where they essentially liquefy and then reform. So it's a time of chaotic form of, you know, I was this, but I'm going to be something else. And I would imagine in that chrysalis period, the known parameters have fallen away to some extent, to some extent. And then the butterfly emerges. And that's how I think of adolescence, is being in the chrysalis, kind of being in that chrysalis stage. But in that stage is a lot of innate power. Any time of transformation, you know, whether it's a transformation of a country, you know, transformation of a human being or of a butterfly, you know, a caterpillar becoming a butterfly. There's a lot of power, creative power in that.
You can watch that full conversation by following Wildcard with Rachel Martin on YouTube. The new edition of Joy Harjo's children's book, For a Girl Becoming, is out now.
Support for Wildcard with Rachel Martin comes from Viking, dedicated to creating travel experiences for the thinking person, with programs designed for cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Learn more at viking.com.
Thanks for listening to All Things Considered.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Proven Winners with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens for gardens and landscapes at garden centers nationwide. ProvenWinnersColorChoice.com/NPR. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio, and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression. From Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE.
Ayo, Silver! Away! Horses come and horses go, but there's one that you all know. People greet him with acclaim, Silver is his name. Give me the reins, there's pep in my veins, onward, westward, ho! Hi-yo, Silver, hi-yo! Over the trail, hill or dale, swift as wind we'll go. Hi-yo, Silver, hi-yo! Giddy-up, 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 we must prevent that crime. Giddy up, giddy up, giddy up, giddy up, we'll get there in the nick of time. Under the sky we will fly, a-huntin' we will go. Hi-oh, Silver, hi-oh.